For the past 8 weeks, we've been devoting these Friday editions of Please Explain to questions about our future survival on Earth. How can we pollute less and manage the waste we create? How can we feed the world's hungry and provide enough water for everyone? And how to deal with a population explosion that's estimated to balloon from the current 7 billion to perhaps 9, 10, or even 15 billion? Today on this final edition of Please Explain series within the series How to Save the World, we're going to talk about sustainability and whether there's a real possibility for world peace. And there may be few people on the planet better qualified to consider these subjects than Jeffrey Sachs, who joins us now. He is a world-renowned economist, the director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University, and the special advisor to UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. Welcome back to our show.
Great to be with you, and thanks for doing this series, which is so important.
And we invite our listeners, who have been very enthusiastic about the series up until now, to call and participate. Our number here is 212-433-9692, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Jeffrey, wherever one is in the world, whether we're in the richest country on Earth or in places where terrible poverty is the norm, the problems we've spent the past few weeks exploring seem almost insurmountable. And I thought we might start by talking about a speech that John F. Kennedy made about achieving peace, which you've written about. Can you tell us about that?
Well, that's my favorite speech. thanks for raising it. John F. Kennedy was grappling with the global survival in the wake of the Cuban Missile Crisis. And in 1963, the last year of his life, and just after the October 62 missile crisis, Kennedy redoubled his efforts to sign a test ban treaty with the Soviet Union. And I think it was an act of great statesmanship and enormous leadership that Kennedy exhibited in that final year. Absolutely remarkable. He gave a speech in June 1963 on commencement day at American University. It's called the Peace Speech, and he said that it's possible to achieve peace. And what I always found remarkable about that speech, which I would encourage listeners to listen to themselves by going online and looking at and listening to the commencement address at American University, because it is available online. Kennedy did not point the finger to the Soviet Union and say, you have to do A, B, C, D, E in order for us to make peace. He said to the American people, we have to look inside at our own attitudes. We cannot take for granted that we are operating in the best way to achieve peace. This depends as much on us as it does on our adversaries. If we dehumanize the other side, of course, we're never going to find a way to peace. And Leonard, what was remarkable about that magnificent speech, because there are lines in it that are just the most soaring eloquence, Khrushchev listened to that speech, found it completely remarkable, called the American envoy who was in Moscow, Avril Harriman, and said to Harriman, that is the finest speech by an American president since Franklin Roosevelt. And he said, I want to make peace with this man. And indeed, 6 weeks later, the partial nuclear test ban treaty was signed. And it was the very first step on the way to the end of the Cold War. And it's an example of making peace by framing the situation in a way that peace becomes seen as possible, as practicable, as achievable. And it starts with stopping the dehumanization of the counterpart.
Was that after the Bay of Pigs and the Cuban Missile Crisis?
Yes. So the Bay of Pigs, of course, was occurred in the first months of Kennedy's administration. It was a completely bungled policy that was a holdover from the Eisenhower years, actually. But Kennedy went along with it, and he accepted the failure. That was in the spring of 1961, and the missile crisis, which brought the world to the brink of complete annihilation, was in October 1962. This speech was in June 63. The partial nuclear test ban treaty was signed in July 63. And I have to tell you, I had an enormous pleasure last week. I was invited to speak to the United Nations Association in the General Assembly of the UN. And I stood there at the same podium that John Kennedy stood in September 1963 when he reported to the world leaders that indeed there was this ray of hope for the world, because he said, we have just completed this first step to peace in this nuclear test ban treaty. And it's another riveting speech of Kennedy, and of course, all the more poignant in that it was just weeks before his assassination. But in that speech, and it's what I quoted at the podium, he said, Kennedy quoted Archimedes, who explaining the functions of the lever, said, give me a place where I can stand and I shall move the world. And then Kennedy turned to the world leaders and said, my fellow inhabitants of the world, let us take our stand here in this assembly of nations, and let us see if we, in our time, can move the world to a just and lasting peace. And, of course, 2 months later, he was dead.
But also, we're almost 60 years later, and the nuclear threat is still a real problem around the world. So perhaps we sometimes can solve the little ones, but not necessarily the big ones.
Well, yeah, I think that, of course, you're right, that the nuclear threat remains, and many other threats remain, and there's a tremendous amount of violence in the Middle East still, and the horrific scenes that we're all viewing from Syria these days remind us that war is ever present. And I think history also teaches us something, that even at moments of history that seem triumphant, the march of economics and science can also be unexpectedly a prelude to disaster. And I'm thinking of almost exactly 100 years ago, when the world had gone through the great phase of industrialization, and a then-famed anti-war activist named Norman Angel around 1911, is I believe the publication date, so I think it's almost exactly 100 years, wrote a book called The Illusion of War, where he rightly argued that war is an illusion in the sense of actually being able to accomplish anything in our modern world, because we're so interconnected that the destruction brings all sides down, the winners, as so-called, as well as the losers. And, of course, it was just 2 years or 3 years after that that World War One erupted without any compelling reason, and it became the most destructive event in human history up to that point. So, no, we have not figured out the key to ending war by any means, and vigilance is absolutely essential, and learning the lessons of history in many ways can help us, though if we think that our work is done, we'd be foolhardy, we'd be absolutely reckless.
It's been said that we're in an Anthropocene age. What does that mean?
We're in something, a time that is unique for us. And this term Anthropocene is a combination of two Greek parts, anthropos, meaning human, and scene, C-E-N-E, meaning epoch or age of the planet, because scene, like Holocene or Pleistocene, is a geologic epochal age. And so this phrase was coined a few years ago by a Nobel laureate atmospheric scientist named Paul Crutzen, who said that we've entered a period on the planet where humanity has taken over the core fluxes of the natural environment. And what does that mean? The water cycle, what we call the hydrologic cycle, the nitrogen cycle, the carbon cycle. These are fundamental ways that the Earth changes over time. But now humanity, because of our $70 trillion annual economy, because we burn fossil fuels in such large amounts that we release into the atmosphere 30 billion tons of carbon dioxide each year, because to feed 7 billion people, we put so much nitrogen-based fertilizer, about 100 million tons per year, that we've poisoned the rivers and estuaries around the world with so-called nitrogen loading. So this is what the Anthropocene means. It means that we're so crowded, 7 billion, and as you said at the beginning of the show, on our way to 8 billion, and by the way, not in the distant future, that's expected to happen by 2024, 12 years from now, on our way to 9 billion, which according to the UN medium fertility forecast will happen in 2044, on our way to 10 billion, which is on that same forecast path expected to occur in 2084. A crowded planet that, despite our sluggish economy in the United States, is still growing very rapidly in resource use worldwide, especially because of China and India and other giant economies that are picking up steam. And the result is that the pressures that humanity is putting on the planet, and as you've been discussing these weeks, is so large that we're at a time of history that we've never experienced before. And what's alarming, of course, is our psyches are not ready for it, and our politics are absolutely not ready for it.
If I want to get into that for sure. Just a moment. So Anthropocene means that humans are responsible for the major changes on Earth today, but that has become a bone of contention in the political arena, as you suggest. It's what Rick Santorum said was at the heart of what he termed President Obama's phony theology. So how do we get past that?
We're in a situation, I can tell you, Leonard. I'm traveling all over the world all the time, and America is standing out right now in a kind of denial that puts us apart from the rest of humanity. In our country, up to half of the population, according to the surveys, says, well, the humans are not really changing the climate. America is, of course, being pummeled with corporate propaganda saying that. And I put most of the blame on that propaganda, just like the tobacco industry spent a fortune and tried to mystify the relationship between tobacco and lung cancer for many, many years until they finally gave up. We're still in a denial phase. Now, this plays into some people's religious beliefs also, because the scientific evidence is overwhelming that if you look at the patterns on Earth over millions of years and tens of thousands of years, you find the strong relationships between carbon dioxide, which now humanity is driving, and climate. But if for religious fundamentalist reasons you believe the Earth is 5,000 or 7,000 years old or whatever it is, well, then you might not accept science as the basis for that. I don't know what Rick Santorum really believes, but I know that the worldwide scientific community is aghast that a major candidate for the United States, the second largest emitter of carbon dioxide in the world, seems to have no compunction at all to be totally 100% ignorant or dismissive of science. He can believe what he wants religiously, but if he's going to lead this country, if he wants to lead it on the basis of anti-scientific views, then he should at least explain to the public that his views are completely repudiated by scientists worldwide. And I can tell you, I don't see anything like it in the rest of the world, what's happening in our politics.
My guest on today's edition of the series within a series on Please Explain How to Save the World is Jeffrey Sachs. He is an economist, the director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University, and the special advisor to UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. Have we been putting too much faith in technology to save us from all the problems we're creating?
Well, it's a complicated issue and a paradoxical one, because technology brought us to where we are in living standards. We like our technologies. We like to live to 80 years on average in the high-income world, not the 25 or 30 years before technology. I'm speaking to you on my mobile phone. You're broadcasting through modern technology, and I'm looking out at an airport scene right now. We're surrounded by technology. It's our lives. And when I spend time, as I do, in villages without technology, I see children dying of lack of safe water. I see people going hungry. I see children dying of diseases for which there are technological solutions. So technology has made the modern world, and in my view, has improved the modern world enormously. But, and here's the but of technology, it's also imperiling us at this point, because our technologies are imperfect. We like our electricity a lot. We use it for just about everything these days. But when we produce electricity with coal, oil, or natural gas, we change the climate. And we're on a verge, because of the scale of what we're doing, of changing the climate in such an adverse, dangerous, unknown way that we will end up, if we continue on this path, very likely cutting our own life support systems out from under us. So technology has brought us here. If we were to just dial down, put down our phones, put down radio, stop our cars, get out and walk, millions, billions of people would perish, because you couldn't support 7 billion people in this world with technologies that once upon a time supported fewer than a billion people, and not very well. So we're a little bit stuck. Our technologies need to change. They need to change pretty dramatically and pretty rapidly. They need to change despite the vested interests of the corporate sector, or the, I don't know how to put it, the willful anti-science of our politicians. They need to change pretty quickly. And to change, they're going to need even more science to change and more technology. So I don't think we're going to get out of the technology loop. But what we are going to need to do is move to sustainable technologies. We're going to have to harness solar power. We're going to have to harness wind power. We're going to have to harness advanced photosynthesis that can make bioenergy in new ways. The good news in all of this, because it's a pretty fraught time, the good news is the technology has never been better. The advances have never been faster. If we can find the human will, coming back to John Kennedy, and the ability to envision what a safer future can look like, we won't lack for the tools to get there. What we seem to be lacking now is the capacity to function as a society that honors our knowledge, that respects science, that is ready to make decisions that require a time horizon beyond the next corporate quarter or beyond the next election. And I would say that our institutions in this regard, whether they're the corporate institutions or whether they're the political institutions, are failing us very badly at a time when we need them to work.
Jeffrey, during these segments, we invite our listeners to join in. Our number here is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. And Tedla from Flushing has called in to join the conversation. Hi, Tedla.
Yes, good afternoon, Mr. Lopez. Good afternoon, Professor Jeffrey. I have a very direct question to Professor Jeffrey Sash. I know him. He's traveling to my country, Ethiopia, and he's encouraging in the northern part of Ethiopia for forestation program and for water conservation. I commend him on that. But one thing I have never heard from him is that what is going on in southern and western part of Ethiopia, where corporations are buying huge amounts of land from the farmers, and they are taking away the subsistence agriculture, and they are producing foods to export to Gulf nation, to Arabia, to India. This is not acceptable. If we destroy subsistence agriculture in Ethiopia, where 80% of our population live, how are you going to survive? Ethiopian population is going to be tripled by the year 2050, according to the UN study. So what I'm asking Professor Sash, like I asked Professor Stiglitz, which I met a few weeks ago in fundraising, how comes their voice is silent in Ethiopia's farmers when they are now? In fact, Professor Sasha, let me be honest with you. Now in the western part of Ethiopia, farmers are revolting. Farmers are starting to protect their land by any means. So Melissa Zenawi, which you support very much, is destroying Ethiopian agriculture.
Let me answer if I might. First, thank you. I speak out all the time on exactly what you're talking about, and it does illustrate one of the real dangers of our crowded planet right now. One of the things that's happened over the last 10 years is that food prices have soared worldwide. Energy prices have soared, copper prices have soared, other minerals prices have soared, because the demand, especially from China, for example, or from the Middle East, like you say, is rising, and the finite planet is gasping to keep up with this demand. And so in that context, one of the things that happens is that the weak and the powerless can easily be displaced by the powerful and by the corrupt. And I'm actually in Washington today to have a discussion at the World Bank about the extractive industries. So even aside from agriculture, you have similar phenomena in mining right now, where people can be displaced, pushed aside because the high prices of minerals. So I'm in complete agreement. This kind of phenomenon, what we call a land grab, is absolutely not only against the interests of the individual farmers, it is a profound danger for Africa as a whole. Just to reassure Tedla, I speak out about that all the time.
And as you've pointed out, much of human conflict and war has been over questions of wealth or access to resources, which is part of what we are discussing today on Please Explain, in the last of this series on how to save the world. Jeffrey Sachs is my guest. He is a world-renowned economist, the director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University, and the special advisor to UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. We will be taking your calls at 212-433-9692, also going over some of your comments that you've left on our show page at WNYC.org right after this. And we're back with Jeffrey Sachs, who's visiting us on this last installment of our Please Explain series within a series on how to save the world. A little ambitious. But he knows something about this. It's something he's been discussing over the years. He is an economist, the director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University, and the special advisor to UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. And that last caller brought up an issue that goes way beyond Ethiopia, but Ethiopia is just one example. Much of human conflict and war has been over questions of wealth or access to resources. Do people have to feel that they have enough in order for peace to be possible?
I think there are two aspects of this that are very clear. Some resource wealth, like obviously diamonds, gold, and especially oil, have long been the object of war. And it's no accident that so much of the conflict in the world right now is in the oil zone. Big powers compete view this as a part of national strategy. And there you have it. So conflicts over resources have long been with us. There's another side to this, which is very important also and relevant for Ethiopia, Somalia, the other countries in the Horn of Africa, and that is that when people don't have enough to survive, when they're struggling for mere subsistence, this also leads to massive violence, not to the large technological wars, but to a lot of slaughter, as well as to famine and death from deprivation. So it's been found in recent studies, including at the Earth Institute, that failures of rainfall, for example, in the poor countries in Africa significantly raise the probability of violence, civil war, or even interstate war. And this means that we have to be attentive to sustainability and to the development of the poorest places in the world if we're not going to end up with the kind of Somalias, Yemens, Afghanistan, after all, and other impoverished places sliding into conflict, which is terrible for them, spills over boundaries, but in an interconnected world where terrible things can go international, we know that it ends up implicating the United States and other countries as well. We have to care about this, and that's why I cringe so often when we view a situation like a Somalia or an Ethiopia or Yemen purely in military or strategic terms and somehow overlook the fact that it's the underlying hunger, poverty, and disease that was a precursor to the violence that then ended up either as terrorism or as piracy or as civil war or mass migration. We have to get to the root of these crises as well if we're going to at least diminish significantly their frequency.
The UN was created after World War II to eliminate the kinds of problems we're facing. So what role should it have if the members of the UN can't agree on something like censure for the actions of the Assad government in Syria? How can it tackle the bigger issues that have to be worked out?
I think, first of all, it is important to realize that even with the violence that we see, that the amount of violence, the amount of war has been going down. We've been blessed to be in an era of recent decades when there has not been a cataclysmic war, thank goodness. We wouldn't be talking on the radio had there been one, but there might have been. The UN has served an extremely important role in keeping us alive, keeping the world out of mass conflict, and of resolving many, many wars around the world, but not all of them. And we do have a set of institutions which give a lot of power to a few big countries, the United States and the other permanent members of the Security Council. When they don't see eye to eye on something, when national interests appear to diverge, or at least appear to the governments to be divergent, then you can't get a resolution through the Security Council, and you can't necessarily get the UN to act in unison. This is how the institution was set up by the United States itself after World War II.
Let's take some calls. Robert from Brooklyn, you're on the air.
Hi. You were speaking eloquently about how people who consider themselves fundamentalists or are considered fundamentalists might ignore the science of the various ways that the planet's having problems. But what about people in the United States, say, who are not fundamentalists, who believe, as you'd say, in science, but at the same time can't see the link between what their particular actions are doing in the larger context in terms of screwing things up, and, you know, as a result, don't don't, you know, overthrow the government for supporting corporate propaganda that does all that.
Mm-hmm. He's saying, in effect, a lot of us are living in denial.
Well, yes, denial or just not clear. So what does it mean for me? Climate change is a particularly difficult issue in this regard, in that every time we drive a car, every time we turn on a light switch, every time we flip on our computer, we're using electricity that is largely being produced by fossil fuels, meaning carbon emissions. This is happening worldwide, and it's happening now at a scale which is imperiling the planet. What do you want me to do about it? This is the question. Now, here's an irony and a very deep danger. The corporate lobby in the energy sector, especially big oil, now natural gas, which is the most hyped energy source of our day, the coal industry, which operates in more than 20 countries, has such a powerful hold on the political system that not only does the political system not actually do anything to solve this conundrum, the president hardly even talks about it, and the Republicans completely deny it. So the level of conversation coming out of Washington is, and with all apologies to the seventh grade, is much less than you would get in a good seventh grade science class. It's absolutely pathetic what's happening. So we don't have a plan. We do not have a national energy strategy. They're even afraid to write one down because then some lobby's going to start campaigning against it. So you can go to the Department of Energy, you can go to the White House, you can go to any part of government. You will not find a strategy for how we can progressively decarbonize our energy system, which is what the United States, China, the European Union, other major economies will have to do over the next 40 years. Can it be done? Yes. Because there are low carbon or zero carbon energy solutions. Are they available right now? No, not in the amount that we need, but we would have to move towards them, improve the development, build a power grid that can carry wind power efficiently from the Dakotas, where it blows the strongest, to the population centers, or to bring the Mojave Desert solar power to the population centers. We need new technologies to store intermittent power, meaning that when the wind isn't blowing or when the sunshine is occluded by clouds, we can still have a power system. So there are lots of things to do, but our government is not making long-term strategy right now at all. Half the political scene is in total denial for whatever reason, ideological, corporate, whatever. And the other is afraid, basically. Don't leave any hostages to fate. Just don't put too much paper out there. And we're adrift. And it's very dangerous because nature doesn't care about our political system. Nature cares about the carbon dioxide parts per million, which rise every year now between 2 and 3 parts per million worldwide, meaning that we're approaching or already passing thresholds which will put the entire world in significant peril.
We don't have a lot more time, but I want to get a bunch of people in here, so I hope that we can move
Absolutely.
Through these questions quickly.
The
Heather from Long Island, hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, how are you? You had a lot of great points. I just had a quick question on your opinion regarding the last caller and agribusiness in general. But I'm actually doing a legal internship now with the United Nations, and I'm working a lot with Rio Plus 20,
right.
And it's wonderful, a lot of the moves that are being made. However, with all the issues with agribusiness and technology transfer, and as an advisor to the Secretariat General, do you think that having perhaps a UN advisory group as a separate mechanism to be able to gauge the technology that's being distributed in these other countries and developing countries, such as India and Ethiopia, the issues there with agribusiness, do you think that would be perhaps a solution to this?
One of the interesting things that I think is going to happen in the next year or two is the world is likely to adopt some sustainable development goals. That may happen as soon as the Rio Plus 20 conference in June. At least the concept of so-called SDGs, sustainable development goals. Within that will come the question of what kinds of technologies can achieve sustainable development, meaning economic progress combined with environmental sustainability. And what you're suggesting will be part of that process. I've been discussing it with the UN leaders and, of course, with the Secretary General, and I know that the intention is that with these new sustainable development goals, we're going to have a very, very interesting and very concerted look at the technological possibilities for moving forward.
Thank you, Heather. Sue from New Jersey, you're on the air.
Hi, Mr. Sachs. With all the political polarization these days, we had the Gulf oil crisis that lasted in everybody's mind about 5 minutes. What kind of crisis will it take to get people moving?
Well, I think we're going to need to break free of this corporate control of our government. You see how these super PACs are paid for by a few billionaires. It's on both sides. And they're really dominating our politics right now.
You noted in one of your papers that we spend $1.2 million per minute in support of the Pentagon. Do you think it's likely in the current political climate that any meaningful cuts can be made on those expenditures?
Well, I think that if we can end these two miserable and wasteful wars, Iraq and Afghanistan, we would save a lot of money. If we would close down some of the bases that are still defending against a Soviet invasion 20 years after the Soviet Union ended, we'd save some more money. I think it's all possible. What has happened, though, is not so much polarization in our politics, but corporatization of our politics. It's really two parties in the hands of big money interests. And I'm hoping that we will begin to mobilize against that. It's not going to happen immediately. There's going to be more money in this election cycle than ever before. We have to start building for the future with candidates who reject these big bucks and who will win on the basis that the people will trust them precisely because they're not in the pockets of the corporations.
We thank you so much for your call. Terrence, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, thanks. My quick question is, we've been hearing for the last decade or so or more that we have to change rapidly to address the threats of climate change. And I guess my question is it already too late, or what's the difference between taking radical change now and, you know, a business-as-usual approach continuing on the same path?
Have we passed the tipping point?
According to my very esteemed colleague, maybe the world's leading climate scientist, James Hansen, we've already passed a threshold, 350 parts per million, in which in earlier phases of the Earth's history, ocean levels have been several meters higher than they are now, because at that level of carbon concentration, the great ice sheets have melted, what it means is that over time, whether it's decades or a century or two centuries, even at this level, says Dr. Hansen, we may already have lost significant parts of the inhabited planet. Now, this doesn't mean give up, doesn't mean panic, doesn't mean end hope by any means. The more we do to head this off, the fewer are the disasters we're going to have to cope with in the future. In other words, this is a kind of progressive loss. The more carbon dioxide you accumulate in the atmosphere, the worse things will be. The faster we head it off, the better and safer we're going to be. We're already on a path that's very dangerous. I don't think anyone should not realize, I mean, everyone should realize that, but that doesn't mean that we're lost. It means we have to speed up what we're doing, do the best we can to avoid what really could be calamity if we absolutely put our head in the ever-warming sand and went on as business as usual. Then the extent of the calamities, I think, would be frightening, phenomenal, because we'll lose a lot of the agriculture in many parts of the world. We would have
And we have to leave it there.
Crisis. Let's not leave it there because these are there are solutions. We just have to get our act together.
Jeffrey Sachs.
Your show has helped to do that.
Thank you so much.